Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Wednesday, the 22nd of February, the Supreme Court, probably in October, will be hearing Fisher versus the University of Texas, and it will give the Roberts Court its first opportunity to rule on the constitutionality of affirmative education in affirmative action, in higher education. There are five justices who are on record opposing racial balancing policies, Justices Scalia and Thomas, in addition to Roberts, Alito, and Kennedy. The Texas case also arises in unusual circumstances, which could limit the significance of the court's ruling. Here's a little bit of the background here. In 1997, the legislature in the state of Texas adopted the top 10 plan for choosing new students. The University of Texas was told to accept the top 10% of the graduates from all of the state's high schools, and the goal was to maintain racial and ethnic diversity in the freshman class without using race as a factor. In 2008, Abigail Fisher was turned down for admission to the school. Her grades were not good enough to put her in the top 10% of her class. She said her tests and grades exceeded those of many of the admitted minority candidates, and she sued, alleging racial discrimination in violation of the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection of the laws. Joining us this hour to talk about this particular case and affirmative action is Professor Brian Fitzpatrick. He is an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Fitzpatrick, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. The last time the Supreme Court looked at this, can you talk about the 2003 case, which evidently was at the University of Michigan and did deal with the issue of race? So will they be updating, modifying that decision, changing that decision?
Well, that's a good question, and only time will tell whether they simply apply the 2000 decision to this case, or there's a chance, I think, that they could actually overturn their 2003 decision. And what happened in 2003, it's actually a pair of decisions. One was called the Grutter decision, and one was called the Gratz decision. One was a lawsuit against the University of Michigan's undergraduate admissions policy, and one was a lawsuit against the University of Michigan's law school admissions policy. And what the Supreme Court held in this pair of cases by a 5-4 vote was that it was permissible for a public university to use race as a factor in deciding who is admitted for the purpose of achieving the educational benefits of racial diversity. So they said it's okay to use racial preferences if you're trying to achieve the educational benefits of diversity. And what they said was in the undergraduate case, however, the way the university used race was too mechanical. They just awarded a certain number of points if you were African American or if you were Hispanic, that affected your chances. They said that's too mechanical, and so they struck down the policy for the undergrads, even though they said in principle the universities could use race. The law school policy they upheld and said that race was used as one of many factors in a very holistic kind of way. There was no mechanical awarding of points. It was just a much more vague, less transparent way to consider race, and the court said that's okay. And so that's where the universities have been now for about a decade. They had the blessing of the Supreme Court to use race so long as they didn't do it mechanically. And it took many people by surprise that the court decided to take this case because it's possible that maybe the court, the personnel has changed the court. O'Connor, who was in the 5-4 majority in the Michigan cases, has left and been replaced by Justice Alito, who's more conservative than she is. And some people wonder, are they going to overturn the cases and say now it's not okay for universities to use race to try to achieve the educational benefits of diversity?
Hmm. I was listening to some reports last night, and the question was brought up as to whether or not this could even be legitimate. And I assume it is because it's going to the Supreme Court. But the young woman who brought the suit didn't go to school in Texas, went to school in another state, and is about to graduate.
Yes. Yes, that's a very good question, and it's often a question of standing or mootness. So her education is going to be over by the time this case is decided.
Right.
And so the question is, why is she a proper litigant? And there, there's an argument here the case is going to be moot and therefore should be dismissed. The problem is there's an exception to the mootness doctrine for cases where it's going to be very difficult to ever find someone who could challenge the action because of the time that it takes for litigation to ensue will always moot out whoever could bring the challenge. So if she can't sue and win because she's about to graduate, then any student that doesn't get into UT is going to go to another school and graduate in 4 years, and because litigation takes longer than 4 years, they're always going to be mooted out. This is an exception to the doctrine. If no one can challenge it because the time would always moot someone out, then they say it's okay for anyone to challenge it despite the fact that they're going to graduate.
I see. Now, Texas, and I wonder if this is an unusual system, provides admission for those in the top 10% of the high schools.
Yes.
Has that resulted in a significant number of minority students entering the university?
Yes. So now the Texas situation is very unique, or it's close to unique. And so if the Supreme Court wants to rule narrowly by applying Grutter to Texas, it won't necessarily affect many other schools, even if they strike it down. And now what Texas did was, in 1996, Texas lost the ability to use race as a factor because the Court of Appeals in Texas, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, held that it was unconstitutional. And this was, you know, years before Grutter basically said it was. And so Texas couldn't use race because of the Court of Appeals decision. So they decided to adopt something called the Texas 10% Plan. And this plan, as you said in your introduction to this topic, allows any student who graduates in the top 10% of their high school class to attend, if they want to, the University of Texas at Austin, the flagship public university in Texas. And the reason Texas adopted this system was to achieve the same racial diversity they had when they used race explicitly as a factor. And the reason it works so well is because the high schools in Texas are segregated by race still.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you take the top 10% of all of them, you get a pretty good reflection of what the state looks like. And so now not everyone who gets in the top 10% chooses to go to UT Austin, of course. You know, it's a very demanding school, and for some people it wouldn't make sense because they come from not very high-quality high schools. But a lot of people are choosing UT Austin, and what we've found is this. In the most recent classes, 80% of all of the freshmen at UT Austin are filled just through the top 10% plan.
Oh, my.
And it results in about 20% of the freshman class being African-American or Hispanic. So it's a lot of diversity they get just by choosing top 10%. Now, what the university did after the Grutter case in 2003 said it was okay for Michigan to use race, what the university did was they said, okay, we're getting a lot of diversity, frankly, from our top 10% plan. But now that we have the green light to use race as a factor again, we want to do that as well. So what they're doing right now is for 80% of the spots, it's automatic. People are getting in by being the top 10%. For the other 20% of the spots, the university is now again using race as a factor to get even more diversity than they got from the top 10% plan. And so the question is, in the case, does the university need to use race as a factor if they were already getting so much diversity by not using race as a factor just by going with the top 10%?
Mm. Is it true, though, that the minority population in Texas is quite high, and 20% may sound good, but I think I heard yesterday that 50% of the students are Latino or African American?
Yeah, this is a great point. And so Texas is much more diverse than 20%. It's almost a 50-50 state now. You're absolutely right. And so the question, though, is that legally relevant? Because if the rationale for using race as a factor is the educational benefits of diversity, the question arises, how much diversity do you need to get the educational benefits? Is 20% enough diversity to get the educational benefits, or do you need 30% or 40%? In other words, if what you're trying to do is simply match the population of the state, the Supreme Court is probably going to say that's racial balancing. That's like a quota that doesn't necessarily correspond to educational benefits. But if you can show a certain percentage is needed for a critical mass in the classrooms to foster these benefits of cross-cultural exchange and what have you, then you might be permitted to do it under the Grutter. But just kind of, you know, mechanically saying Texas is 50% minority, therefore our universities have to be, isn't necessarily tied to the educational benefits, and so it may go beyond what's legally justified.
Hmm. Well, how in the world do you determine what the critical mass should be? What questions do you ask?
Very difficult. And a lot of critics of the Grutter decision say there's no empirical basis whatsoever, no scientific basis for this notion. It's very hard to figure out. I mean, you could do some mathematical calculations to say how many students do we need to admit in order to have a, you know, 80% chance that there's going to be at least one African American in every class, or this or that. You could do things like that, but there's, you know, in my research on the issue, there's not very robust scientific findings for what constitutes a critical mass and when you get it and how you get it. And so that's one of the criticisms of Grutter and one of the reasons why the Supreme Court may be willing to reexamine it.
Hmm. And Professor Fitzpatrick, what's the situation in other states? Do other states, we got a lot of other states here, allow admissions officials to look at the issue of race?
My understanding is, and you know, people don't publicize this because, you know, the more open you are about using race, the more likely it is you're going to get sued. But my understanding is pretty much any selective university, any university that admits fewer students than apply by a significant margin, anyone that admits fewer than apply by a significant margin, any selective school like that is using race as a factor. So I think it is true of most of the flagship public universities in the states in America.
Mm-hmm. And tell me how the decision, I don't know how this works, how the Supreme Court would have decided to take this particular case.
So, you know, there's nine justices, and in order to take a case, four of them have to agree to take it. So you don't need a majority of the court to vote to take a case. So just because the court takes a case doesn't necessarily mean that there's majority support for reversing what happened below. In this case, what happened below was the Court of Appeals in Texas upheld Texas's use of race as a factor in addition to the 10% plan. But because it only takes four votes in the court to take a case, you could have four angry conservatives who want to reverse, but they may not be able to pick up a fifth vote.
We go to phone calls. We have a couple of them right now, and I'm sure we'll have more as the hour carries on. Here's our number. Our conversation this hour is on affirmative action. The Supreme Court has decided to take up a case. It's Texas related of affirmative action for college admissions. It will be heard by the court right before the November election. We had to talk about the political implications of this, which we'll do with our guest in a moment. Professor Brian Fitzpatrick, Associate Professor of Law at Vanderbilt University, is our guest. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today is dedicated to all of the bench warmers and understudies who are in our audience. We were captivated, everybody is, by the story of Jeremy Lin, and we'll be talking about the many angles of this story. We'll have three guests with us, the staff writer for Time, who wrote a very interesting piece about Lin in the current issue of the magazine. We'll speak with Mitch Nellis, who is a co-host of the Afternoon Drive show on ESPN Radio 540 here in Milwaukee. And we'll be speaking with Doc Shepler, who's the girls' basketball coach at Pinewood High School in Los Altos, California. Shepler spent quite a number of hours training Jeremy Lin. So, that's our show. An unusual one for us, but I think it will be fun. Hour two. All right, affirmative action in the Supreme Court this hour. We start our phone calls with Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hello there.
Hi, Scott.
Hi. You know, I have just a curious curiosity I have about this. I'm old enough, as Kathleen well knows, to remember that well back in the 70s, there was a California case of a kid applying to graduate school and was turned down, and he made the argument, and I don't know if it got to the Supreme Court or not, but he made the argument that he was being discriminated against because he was a white male. And the argument at that time, or one of the questions that was raised, was that I think they called it the Bill Cosby kid syndrome. In other words, where you would take somebody who was of a different racial group, but you would, just because they're of that racial group, you would give them something that was considered an advantage in society, whereas maybe they could afford it on their own, and it maybe should. Instead, the argument was, well, why didn't you do this for people who were disadvantaged? Because disadvantaged come in all races, creeds, whatever. And I guess my question is, I'm not hearing that around this case now. And I guess what I'd like to know from you is, are they defining diversity in some other way, or is that still a factor that's being applied to these cases? In other words, where does relative economic disadvantage start, and how does that relate to diversity? Because I could see a circumstance where you had a diverse racial group, but it was all, well, they were all the kids of doctors, accountants, and, you know, radiologists.
Good question.
Yes, so one of the criticisms of affirmative action is that it basically replaces poor white and Asian students with upper-class African-American and Hispanic students. That is definitely one of the criticisms. I've seen some empirical support for that notion, but, you know, it's very hard to study things like that with any certainty. But that is a criticism. Now, when the Supreme Court said in 2003 it's okay for universities to consider race a factor, what they said was, in doing that, universities have to consider lots of other factors in the mix as well. It just can't all be about race. And so you've got to look at other types of diversity as well, because other types of diversity are going to bring the same educational benefits that racial diversity brings. And so the courts, you've got to look at other diversity attributes. And so, you know, arguably, under a decision like Grutter, in order to justify using race effect, you've got to look at things like socioeconomic diversity as well. And now, are universities doing that is a better question. There has been a movement among some of our top private universities in America to basically make it free for poor families to send their kids there. At Harvard now, for example, I think your family can make up to $100,000 a year, and your kid can go to Harvard for free. And it's an effort to try to bring more economic diversity to universities. Now, that's at Harvard. I don't know what Texas is doing in that regard. I don't know what other schools are doing in that regard. But this is a legitimate concern with affirmative action and how it's being implemented in the universities. Is it increasing racial diversity only to decrease economic diversity?
Hmm. Anything else, Scott?
No, that's it.
All right,
thank
you.
Thank you. That explains it very well.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hello. I'm old enough to have acquired some advanced degrees, and I've been to several universities ranging from a small liberal arts a Baptist school with less than 3,000 students is pretty much lily white, all the way up to places like the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the University of Washington, Washington State University, all of which have stated policies of encouraging high racial diversity through affirmative action. And my experience, first of all, personally as a student, and no one I knew ever chose a university simply because of diversity. They went there because there were programs that they wanted to take advantage of that were particularly advantageous to them. And I never gave racial diversity even a moment's thought when I was choosing one school or another to go to. And I'm questioning the assumption that that diversity is even a desirable trait, because at the University of Wisconsin, for example, and I guess the University of Washington I can speak to, because they're similar size. besides universities. You saw a lot of African-American students admitted on affirmative action who otherwise perhaps would not have qualified academically. And they tend to self-segregate. In other words, there was very little diversity, in fact, because, you know, the black students would self-segregate. And also, because they come from educationally disadvantaged areas, a lot of times they drop out after only a year because they can't handle the academics. And so there's really very little end good accomplished by it.
Professor Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, so this is the debate that's going on among academics and others now. So the universities strongly and sincerely believe that racial diversity does produce educational benefits. I mean, it is almost an article of religion. You know, here at Vanderbilt and every other university I've ever been associated with, they believe it sincerely, that having students of different races on campus in the classrooms makes the educational product that they deliver better. They believe it. Now, what's the evidence for it? There, things are much dicier. And there's a lot of skepticism out there that there is good evidence that there are really many benefits from having different races at the university. And so let me give you some examples. There was a series of briefs that were filed at the court, which may have influenced their decision to take this case, and which will be replicated on the merits when the court hears arguments in October. There was a series of briefs that looked at some studies that were done by a professor at UCLA over the last several years. They're very good studies, and they're not without criticisms, of course, but they're very good studies. What he shows in his studies is that affirmative action actually leads to fewer African Americans graduating from college and succeeding in their fields. He looked at law schools in particular. Because of affirmative action in law school admissions, he has shown you actually end up with fewer black lawyers than you would have if you didn't have affirmative action. Now, why? Well, they go to schools, he says, that they're not qualified to go to. They end up either dropping out altogether because they get discouraged, or they end up doing very poorly in their class and they get discouraged, and they fail the bar at a much higher rate than they would have had they gone to a school that matched their abilities and they could have done well at, had their confidence boosted and been a full academic member of the institution. And so he argues that it's actually having a perverse effect. We're actually getting fewer graduates and fewer success stories because we are mismatching people with their institutions. Now, so, you know, that evidence is going to be before the court, and it's possible it could persuade the court that their decision in Grutter was incorrect, and in fact that the educational benefits are not being generated the way that they had hoped. You know, this is a social science debate. There are studies on both sides on this, but there certainly is the argument out there that these educational benefits are not being generated. If anything, there's actually educational costs, not benefits.
Are there studies on the other side showing the opposite?
Yes. So there are studies criticizing the studies that were done at UCLA. There was a book written before the Grutter cases. Some people say it was written for the Grutter cases to influence the court, called The Shape of the River.
Mm-hmm.
And they go through and they try to isolate some of the benefits of diversity at the universities. And, you know, again, it's hard to quantify this kind of stuff. You know, how can you tell that the educational product is better? How do you measure that? It's very, very difficult. But scientists have tried to do it on both sides, and there is, you know, conflicting thinking about it. But I will say that the prevailing view at the university is that there are educational benefits.
It just points, it's such a large issue in many ways, isn't it? Because it also points to the quality of education before you even get to college, and disparities in schooling and districts and wealthy districts and poor districts. the playing field is not very level.
No, that's exactly right. And so some people ask, are we asking our universities to do too much to try to correct for all of these other inequities that we have in our society? You know, where you live depends on what school you go to, and where you live depends on how much money your family makes.
Right.
And, you know, there's all kinds of inequities that accrue throughout the course of your life, and you get to the point where you're 18, and now we expect universities to take these people in and everything to come out perfectly. No, it's we have much more fundamental changes that need to be made before we can reach anything close to educational equality in this country.
Bill, thanks so much for your call. Mike is next in Monroe. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to say that my daughter, she was an honor student all the way through high school, had excellent grades, and she was not allowed to attend University of Madison, which my tax dollars support, because of this issue. And I just fail to see in this day and age how race should even be figured in into any of this. And your professor there, you know, he talks about diversity, and what does somebody raised in the ghetto, what's he going to bring to the classroom? I mean, and it's, I agree with what they said. It's in this day and age, race should not be figured into anything anymore. It should just be your grades, who's qualified for jobs, for everything. Race should totally be eliminated if we ever are to be a society that isn't racist.
Well, yeah, but you also have to believe that everybody, be they from the ghetto or wherever, from a poor rural area, has something to bring to the table, right? I believe that's what most of us believe these days, that we all can bring something. Professor Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, so, you know, everyone has different life experiences, and so everyone has something unique, arguably, that they have to offer. On the other hand, the question is, you know, do those unique experiences actually manifest themselves at the university? So you kind of have to ask yourself, well, when would they manifest themselves? So one possibility is in the classroom. And, you know, I think that depending on what kind of university you went to, what kind of classes you took, you probably have different intuitions about whether having someone from, you know, a certain upbringing is going to affect the classroom discussion. So, for example, one of the things that one of the judges on the Court of Appeals said, one of the judges who dissented from the Court of Appeals' decision not to rehear this case with the full court, one of the things she said is, you know, I just don't believe that classroom diversity helps in areas like applied math, chemistry, Farsi, or hundreds of other subjects like that. And so, you know, the notion is in some subjects, lecture classes, science, math, what have you, it really doesn't matter the race of the people in the classroom. The class is going to be conducted in the exact same way, whether it's 100% black, 100% white, or 50-50. On the other hand, there's a lot of other classes at the university, you know, classes about politics or government or sociology, where I think it's quite plausible for us to think, classes where it's more based on discussion, it's quite plausible to think that people's experiences may have an impact on what other people take away from the class. In addition to that, you have to think about, well, what's the possibility of there being educational benefits outside the classroom but still on the campus? And so people live together in the same dormitories, people eat lunch together in the cafeterias, people play together on intramural sports teams, they're, you know, in the choir together. You have friends just socially from other races and other walks of life. Doesn't that produce some kind of educational benefit, even if it's not the formal classroom, the informal social interactions? And so that's what the argument is. The argument is that those informal interactions as well can bring educational benefits. And, you know, again, there's a lot of people that don't buy it, but that's the argument.
Mm. Well, next hour we're talking about Jeremy Lin, and our stereotype of Asian Americans who go to Harvard is that they're very, very smart, and they do very, very well in school. And here we've got an Asian American who's a whiz on the basketball court, and just the fact that he is there is making huge waves. So if you have an African American in advanced physics classes in a top-notch university, and he or she happens to be from the ghetto, there they are, and that's a statement in itself, and people take that in.
Now that's a great point, Kathleen, and one of the arguments that the Supreme Court accepted in the Grutter case 2003 was the following. We need a critical mass of minority students on campus because we want to dispel stereotypes about minorities. And you have to have a lot of minorities so that people can realize that there's a diversity of views and experiences even among the minorities. And so if you only have one African-American in the classroom, people worry that that person is going to be seen as speaking for all African-Americans. But if you have 10 in the classroom, and two of them say this and four of them say that, and the other four say something else, then you have taught people that there is a complexity of thought and opinion in the African-American community as well. And so that was one of the arguments the court accepted. Now, again, you know, people question whether that's really going on. People question whether that those benefits are being seen and we can measure them. And some people question, even if those benefits are real, some people say it's still not worth discriminating against whites and Asians.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know all sides of this issue, Professor, don't you? You really do. Mike, thanks very much for the call. Sam in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I want to bring a perspective from Europe. I'm from there, and I'm surprised with this 10% or segregation. They don't care for the race. The brain is gray, and you have to be evaluated. You have to go through the admission test, and who is the best to win and has the right to continue, because the engineers, chemistry and whatever is the future of the country. For that reason, I am surprised why they don't go through the testing. And when I came in USA and I went to college in the chemical technology, they evaluated me. They gave me technical math 2, 750-page book. In a week, I have to challenge 20. I got 60 questions in 2 hours, 2 minutes per each. They test you under the stress. I passed 95%. I went through maybe 6 or 7. The last was college chemistry, 1,000 pages. And after I was evaluated, I was admitted, and I got with honor. That means if you go by prediction, the mixture of the different races, and you forget about the performance of the person, you compromise the future of the country. And no matter you go to the university, if you are not a hard-working person and you are not very persistent, you'll be illiterate after you graduate. And this way you promote illiteracy and ignorance. That means I'm surprised. That is a way to forget the race. Brain is gray. Who is the best has the right to continue. It's meritocracy, my friend. That's it. I hang up now.
All right. Thank you, Sam, for the call. Professor.
Well, you know, this argument carries a lot of rhetorical force with people. So, for example, you know, if you're flying on an airplane, do you want the airline pilot that got admitted to airline school on the high test scores, or do you want the airline pilot that was admitted in part because of their race? If you have a doctor, do you want the doctor that had the highest test scores, or do you want the doctor that got into med school in part because of their race? And so, you know, that's an argument that carries a lot of rhetorical force with people. We want the people who are the best doing these jobs that are important for the country. And if we are relaxing the test scores in order to get diversity, we're going to end up with people who are not as good at doing these particular tasks. And I'll just add, this is a little story. It's an anecdote. It doesn't prove anything, but it's an anecdote. One of your callers mentioned earlier the Supreme Court case in the 1970s on this topic. The case was called the Bakke case. It was Bakke,
right.
the University of California. And that was a student that was trying to get into medical school at the University of California. A white student was rejected at that time it was a quota. The Supreme Court said you couldn't use a quota, but it was okay to use race as a factor. He was rejected under a quota that reserved a certain number of spots in the entering class for African-American students. And so he didn't get into med school. Well, what they did, what some journalists did many years later, they tracked some of the African-American doctors that got in under this quota and wouldn't have gotten in had it not been for the quota, to see what have they done. What have they done with their lives? What do they do with this medical school admissions? It's kind of unfair to you know, track them down as kind of the poster child for affirmative action, but that's what was done. And unfortunately, what they found was that one of the African-American doctors that got in had lost his medical license already for mistreating, I believe actually killing, one of his patients. He became a plastic surgeon and something went awry and one of his patients died and he lost his medical license. And so this has kind of stoked the fires of those who say affirmative action leads to people who are less qualified doing things that are important and that we're going to suffer some consequences from that.
Well, how many C students have become president?
That's the other. We had one, but I think before our current president.
Exactly. Mike in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Presidents don't have to take tests. That's how C students can become presidents. But I have a very interesting anecdote. I did a Freedom of Information request in the mid-1990s at the University of Wisconsin Medical School on behalf of a relative who was trying to be admitted there. And I found that minority students with GPAs as low as 2.38, not even a C-plus average, were in the medical school at UW-Madison. And the medical school was taking these students who are out-of-state students in preference to in-state students who had much higher grades. And the medical school was taking as many as 20% out-of-state students in their classes to fulfill their desire to have minorities. And I got a list of
also to make more money.
School with their MCATs and GPAs, and the minority students were uniformly less qualified than Wisconsin residents who were being denied admission.
There's also a money issue. You get more money for out-of-state students.
No, it's not a question of money for medical school. 2.38 admission to medical school is absolutely ludicrous. And if the people of Wisconsin knew what was going on at the university, they would have a revolt. And it's very hard to get that information. You have to hire lawyers and spend a lot of money on freedom of information requests. I got all the information.
Right. Well, I don't know. I haven't seen your information, but I would find it hard to believe that students with those kinds of grade point averages were being admitted to med school simply because they were minorities. Maybe there is information that supports what he said, Professor Fitzpatrick.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, I think we all have to acknowledge that if we're going to use race as a factor, it means that the people with the best test scores are not necessarily going to get in. I mean, if you use other factors besides test scores, that means the people with the best test scores won't necessarily get in. And there's no question that affirmative action and using race as a factor has led to some minority students, not all. Obviously, there are some very talented minority students that have the same test scores or better test scores than anyone else. But it has led to some minority students with lesser test scores and other academic qualifications gaining admission. There's no doubt about it. That's what the system means. That's what affirmative action means. Now, how big are the disparities? Well, you know, there's a lot of dispute about this. Several years ago, they published some numbers from the University of California at Berkeley, undergraduate numbers, which showed the kind of average SAT score disparity between white students and African-American students that were admitted to be over, 200 SAT points. So that's a pretty big disparity. This is one consideration when we're thinking about, do we want these policies, is number one, are we willing to sacrifice anything on test scores in order to reap some of these possible benefits of racial diversity? That's the first question. Number two is, how much of a disparity are we willing to entertain in order to do it? And those are public policy questions that the people in the court and the legislature are going to have to decide for themselves. There's no right answers to that. There's no wrong answers. How much you value diversity, educational benefits of diversity, versus how much you value, meritocracy. Different people have different answers to that, and I think we may find out in October what the nine people in the Supreme Court think about that.
Mm. And I guess the other question that you have to ask, and I wonder how this is figured in 2012, or if we feel that we're past this, is how much you have to atone for sins of the past, because they were substantial sins.
Now, this is a good point, and this no doubt colors everyone's thinking about the issue. As a legal matter, you're not supposed to think about that, because the universities are saying they're doing this for the educational benefits of diversity, and so everything has to kind of revolve around that as a technical legal matter. But as in reality, we all know that the people making these decisions, including Supreme Court justices, their views are colored by the fact that we have a long and sad history of discriminating against certain groups, and there's no doubt that that discrimination has produced inequities that still linger with us today. And what we do about that is obviously relevant to whether we want to keep these policies around today.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people say, on the other hand, look, we've got an African-American president. Isn't America a fair society? Why do we need these kinds of things? And, you know, I remember during the presidential campaign in 2008, Barack Obama was asked, do you think it would be appropriate for your daughters to receive affirmative action benefits when they apply to college? The daughters of the President of the United States. And I think Barack Obama said it probably wouldn't be appropriate, but the reality is that if his daughters wanted it, they could get it.
Our guest this hour is Professor Brian Fitzpatrick, Associate Professor of Law at Vanderbilt University. We're talking about the Supreme Court deciding to take up the issue of affirmative action once again, based on a University of Texas case. And here is how you reach us. Our phones have been just humming. But there's one opening right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One of our guests the next hour of the program, a reporter for Time Magazine, writes in the current issue, how many Harvard grads and how many Asian Americans were in the current NBA before Jeremy Lin arrived? Zero and zero. Harvard has produced more U.S. presidents, eight, than NBA players, four, and until Lin, none, since the 1950s. We're going to talk about Jeremy Lin and the many aspects of Jeremy Lin that have surfaced as a result of his incredible rise here. We'll have three guests with us: Sean Gregory, staff writer for Time; Mitch Nellis, also known as Thunder, co-host of the Afternoon Drive show on ESPN in Milwaukee and Madison; and Doc Shepler, girls basketball coach at Pinewood High School in Los Angeles, California, who spent many, many hours training Jeremy Lin. Back to phone calls on affirmative action with Professor Brian Fitzpatrick from Vanderbilt University. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Well, I started out my undergraduate career sort of at Carleton College in Minnesota, and I left there a few years off. And when I went back to school, I specifically chose University of Illinois Chicago because I wanted a completely different experience, and I wanted to be in school with people from different backgrounds and ways of life, walks of life, and I really, really liked it there, all in all, and I'm more happy with my education. When I talk to people I know who went to elite schools, I like my education. I loved getting that perspective of other people who grew up in the city in different circumstances. I thought it was really, really valuable for me.
Professor Fitzpatrick.
Yes, so, I think one of the findings from The Shape of the River, that book that we mentioned earlier that is a defense of affirmative action, is that, you know, the people that are in these classrooms and universities in diverse environments like the experience. They report that they think that it has helped their education, that they have benefited from it. And so if you believe the reports of the folks that are admitted to the schools, it's a success. Now, of course, if you ask the people that didn't get in, they may have a different view.
They're unhappy, right? They sure do. We're hearing from people today. Yeah, Sarah, thanks very much for your call. Aaron in Appleton, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a couple stories. They sort of are opposing viewpoints, I guess. But I went to high school in Minnesota. A friend of mine was a salutatorian, 4.0 GPA, a decently well-off family. And then he had a very good friend who was Indian, went to a different high school of about the same size, also salutatorian of his class, same GPA, pretty much the same economic standing. They were almost identical in every way, except his friend was Indian. And when they both applied to the U of M, his Indian friend got a full-ride scholarship, and he didn't get a single scholarship at all. I think situations like that are very unfair. I don't understand why it can't be more need-based. If you've got two essentially identical candidates of different race, I don't understand why the minority gets more money if they can do need-based scholarships, so why not need-based affirmative action? Instead of being based on race, maybe race and economic standing. And the other story you guys brought up, would you rather have a doctor or a pilot who got in based on race or got in based on economic standing? And I guess so this sort of opposes my original story, but my uncle is 100% Cuban and wouldn't have gotten into med school without being Cuban. But now that he did, he succeeded very well there, got almost straight A's all the way through and is a very good surgeon now. I feel like if you've got a pilot or a doctor who got through med school or got through pilot school, I don't see how that should affect your view of how good of a pilot or doctor they're going to be if they got in based on race.
Well, there certainly are a lot of success stories. That is certainly true. And these opposing, stories that the caller brings to our attention, neatly reflects the dilemma that many of us feel on this issue. It's not an easy issue. There's good and bad on both sides. One thing I did want to address in particular is the question of whether let's just say we stopped using race and instead started giving preferences to poor people, would that solve the problem? Would that get us diversity without what I think most people say is at least somewhat unseemly process of giving preferences out based on skin color? And so the empiricists, the social scientists have looked at this question. If we were to just prefer the poor, would we produce diversity? The answer, I'm sorry to tell you, is no. And that was one of the findings in Shape of the River, is that if you replace racial preferences with socioeconomic preferences, you do not get anything close to the amount of racial diversity because poor whites and Asians dramatically outscore poor African Americans and Hispanics on the SATs, on high school GPAs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you just prefer the poor, you're going to end up with a lot of whites and Asians and very few African Americans and Hispanics.
Thanks, Aaron, for your stories. David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, I was interested in this whole, basically as a taxation without representation issue. The way I look at affirmative action, all of these different minorities are taxpayers, and they're not getting the honest use of their own property. They own the schools. They own the universities, just like we do. And for them to be denied admission through some form of either intimidation or fraud, then they're being denied. And if they can be denied taxation with representation, then we're also subject to it, because it's a matter of time before, just like in the old Hitler thing, first they came after the labor people, then they came after the Jews, and I wasn't one of them, so then when they came after me, I didn't have anybody to protect me. By the way, one other thing, you were talking about Bush's C. That was actually a gentleman's C. He probably flunked out of school. Okay. And the other thing is Ralph Nader, I wish you'd interview him about these medical schools. He's done a lot of speeches about the fraud in medical schools. I studied medicine to some degrees, and the very idea that the best doctors are the ones that actually have an interest in it. They're not money grubbers. Most honest doctors want to treat people. And the medical schools are now being run by the HMOs because they want to essentially get a bunch of money-grubbing doctors. And so we, the people, are being cheated out of our own medical schools because we're not allowing the honest doctors to get admitted.
All right, David, I have to hold you there. We have about 30 seconds left. Professor Fitzpatrick?
Yes, the only thing I'd like to say to David is this question of, you know, we're all taxpayers. Does that mean we all have a right to go to the University of Wisconsin at Madison, for example? I mean, the University of Wisconsin at Madison can't take everybody. It's got to make some choices. But even if you can't get into UW-Madison, you can go to another state school. I mean, and that's kind of the findings of this UCLA study, is that we're not talking about denying people any education at all. We're talking about matching people up to the appropriate education. So there's other types of institutions that people can go to besides the flagship institutions.
Well, congratulations to you for being so informative and incredibly balanced. You're just amazing. Thank you very much for being with us, Professor Fitzpatrick.
It was my pleasure. I had a fantastic time.
Good.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Good. I'm glad you did. Professor Brian Fitzpatrick, Associate Professor of Law at Vanderbilt University. Many thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. I hope all of you had a fantastic time. I don't think a guest has ever said that. That's great. Jeremy Lin, the story coming up next.